as I mentioned last week, either in this class or the other, and I don't remember which, we're all supposed to be doing stuff on sustainability this week, and we're supposed to do something in our classes about it. And what struck me about the whole project was that it was entirely one-sided, that everything being scheduled on sustainability took it for granted that sustainability was a good and noble goal, and the only question is how to do it. And that seems to me a very dubious proposition. I accordingly emailed, in response to one of the emails I got from the people in charge of this, raising my concerns, and they, I thought, very kindly offered to let me give a talk giving a critique of sustainability. And so I'll be giving that talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock in the Kennedy Commons. And the title I am using is Sustainability, Empty Rhetoric or a Bad Idea. And you're obviously all welcome to come if you feel like it. But it ought to be interesting. And my guess is there won't be any rotten eggs, but we'll see. I was a little tempted to wear a chainmail shirt since I actually have one, but it may be an over. Not sure how many people have an adequate sense of humor for that sort of thing. All right, I was going to start where we were ending last time, just to make the point again that the book discusses a wage discrimination case and suggests perhaps 0.05 is too strong a requirement for what is, after all, a civil and not a criminal case. And the problem is that sounds as though it means that 0.50 ought to do it. It sounds as though it means, well, civil is supposed to be a better than 50% probability, but that's the standard misunderstanding of significance results, which supposes that 0.05 means the chances are 19 out of 20 that you're guilty, whereas it actually means the chances that we would have evidence that you were guilty this good are, if it wasn't true, is only 1 in 20. And those are not at all the same statement in a reason. So that's why I mentioned that. Any questions on that? Yes.
All right, so one more time. If it's 0.05...
As many times as necessary. Yes. Very, very common, very...
So those are saying, your hypothesis that it is discrimination, or that they are discriminating.
The hypothesis that they're discriminating is false, that they're not discriminating. The evidence that they were, there's only one chance in 20 the evidence that they are discriminating would be as strong. That doesn't tell you what probabilities they're discriminating. It tells you what the probabilities you would have gotten the result you were if they weren't. And as in my standard example, the probability that I would flip a coin three times to get three heads, if it was not a double-sided coin, if it was a bear coin, is only 1 in 8. But that doesn't mean that if it happens, the odds are now 7 to 1 that I've got a double-sided coin. Okay. Make sense?
Well, it's only probability that evidence is accurate. So you can't even say that that's the probability that they weren't discriminating.
That's right. You can't. All you can say is if they weren't discriminating, it is rather unlikely the evidence they were. But if you started out being sure they weren't discriminating, but you looked at their admission, at their employment stuff, and they were doing it at long range and had no information on the gender of the applicants, you would then say, well, that's a very strong reason to believe they can't be discriminated, therefore it must just be random chance that they're out. Make sense? So in a sense, what the confidence result tells you is how much you should shift your opinion about the truth. Yep, maybe quantitative gets more complicated, that's basic statistics. But in a loose sense, 0.05 says if you were really sure they weren't discriminating, now you should be a little unsure. If you had no idea what they're discriminating against, now you should probably think they're probably discriminating, right? Because what it's doing is giving you a reason to shift your opinion, but it is not reporting the probability that either claim is true or false. That's not deducible from Bayesian statistics. Bayesian statistics only if you start with the prior one. You say, I already know the chance somehow that the chance of discriminating is 50-50, then you could mathematically use this information to change it and say, well, it's now 5 to 1.
So when you had an earlier example about a murder trial and you get statistics that say a 0.05 probability that this DNA matches,
right.
So that's telling you how strong the evidence would be if your hypothesis is that he was the killer. It's giving you the probability of the, or what chances the evidence would be, or how good the evidence would be if he was not.
How likely it is you would have evidence this strong that he was if he wasn't. You would think of it as
he wasn't.
That's right. You would think of it as the question, suppose we pick a random person from the population and check you had a 0.05 result, we would say one person out of 20, the DNA would match. And if you think about it that way, you can see that doesn't in any sense mean that you pick a random person and match the odds are 19 to 1 to do the murder. Right. Makes sense? So it's a very common mistake.
As it happens, one of the standard statistical mistakes was the subject of a cartoon. I had a link to it on the syllabus. I don't know if you followed it. How many of you are familiar with XKCD? All right, only one. You should be. It's quite funny. It's a web cartoon which reminds me of sort of a geek version of the old New Yorker cartoons. The New York cartoons weren't a comic strip. They were individual things making a joke, as it were, of some sort. So that, for example, one of my favorite old Charles Addams cartoons is a scene of a pyramid being built in Egypt. And there are a couple of slave driver types. And trudging up the side of the pyramid is this enormous giant with a huge block of stone on his shoulders. And the caption of one of the slave drivers saying to the other is, "We never could have done it without him." That's the explanation for how they built the pyramids. They had this 50-foot tall guy carry their stones for them. So that was a New Yorker cartoon. But XKCD is a geek version of that on the web, of usually more than a single thing. But this particular one is actually on statistics and is very good. So I'm assuming that this thing, yes, good. Even though it's not my computer, here we are. Jelly beans cause acne. Scientists investigate. But we're playing Minecraft. My son knows what Minecraft is. I don't. We found no link between jelly beans and acne. Probability greater than 0.05. In other words, the chance that the correlation between eating jelly beans and getting acne would be this high was more than 1 in 20 there, using 0.05 as their level. That settles that. I hear it's only a certain color that causes scientists. But Minecraft. We found no link between purple jelly beans and acne. We found no link between brown jelly beans and acne. Probability greater than 0.05. We found no link between pink jelly beans and acne. No link between blue jelly beans and acne. No link between teal jelly beans and acne. No link between salmon jelly beans and acne. No link between red jelly beans and acne. No link between turquoise jelly beans, magenta jelly beans, yellow jelly beans. Let's keep going just a minute. Yellow jelly beans, gray jelly beans. We found a link between green jelly beans and acne. Probability less than 0.05. We found no link, we found no link, we found no link. News, green jelly beans linked to acne. And you see why that argument, what the point that they're making is. Yep?
It's the problem that we were talking about last time. The obvious news ran regression that you've done more than 50.
That's right. And they're making the point by using the colors. They've done more, they've checked more than 20 colors. And one of them gave a result that has only one chance in 20 happening by chance. Great. Surprise. And then you report that result, of course, because that's what makes the news story. So I thought it was worth noting that, because the fact that here you've got what actually is quite a good cartoon, which is making a serious statistical point and doing it quite well. All right. So now let's, you know.
You
can use anything you like, as long as, although it's probably a good idea to decide what you're using before you do the regression, otherwise you'll always be tempted to expand it to whatever will fit. No, each of all any of these numbers is a statement of how likely your result would be to happen if the hypothesis was true, if the thing you're testing to see if something is false and how likely it is to happen if it's true. So a different way of putting it is, say, if I use a 0.05 level and I do lots of experiments, one time out of 20, out of the times when the thing I'm looking for isn't there, I'll find it one time out of 20, if 0.05. If I want to cut it down to only find it one time out of 100, I'd use 0.01. If I said, well, I'm willing to accept more errors in that direction in order to spot things, maybe I'll use 0.10. Right? There's nothing special about 0.05 because it's a fairly common level you would use to send it. That's all. It's nothing bad. So now let's think about this question. It seems to be a nice one for trying to apply what we've learned. We'd like to raise the bar passage rate. We'd like to raise the bar passage rate for two unrelated reasons. One of them is that the law school would be better off with a higher bar passage rate because we get a higher rating in U.S. News and World Report, and more and better students would want to give us their money to come to the law here. That's a selfish incentive from the standpoint of the school. The second is that it seems a terrible waste for students to spend 3 years of work and a whole lot of money and then never be able to practice law. So, insofar as we're trying to do good in the world as well as benefit ourselves, we would prefer, if we could, to raise the biomass. And suppose we've got data on what we knew about students when they applied, what courses they took, what grades they got, what their bar exam outcomes were. In practice, the data we usually have is whether or not they passed the bar the first time they took it, because there's something you need to pick. They don't have good records on that. And the question is, how might you use that data? What questions might you ask? What things might you think about changing in order to raise the bar passage rate? And how could statistics answer? So before I go on to my suggestions, first, do you have certain ideas that occurred to you? What you might, what questions you might want to ask, what tactics you could imagine using, and how statistics would know. Yeah?
Even though, there's some definite, selection problems, I just want to know the obvious thing. What teachers and courses correlate with high bar pass rate?
So one thing you could do is to say, if I look for students, first at which courses they took, are there correlations? Do we find that people who took a certain course are more likely to pass the bar? Other courses. If they do, then maybe the courses that raise bar passage rate, it's not really the right way of putting it, ones we suspect of raising the bar passage rate, are ones we ought to make everybody take, or encourage more people to take, or something. And second, with regard to teachers, if it turns out that people who took property from one professor did better than people who took it from another professor, maybe the second professor should be fired or transferred to teaching something else, and the first professor should be asked to teach more property and less of some unimportant thing. Those are clearly two possibilities. Can you see the problem? What are the ways in which you might get the correlation and yet the solution might not work?
This is a selection problem. Smarter students may take different professors.
That's right.
Classes.
That's right. So you could easily enough imagine a case where what's going on is that Paul Gota, back when he was here, had the reputation, I gather, of being a very hard grader. And one possible result of that is that only students who, A, were pretty confident and B, were willing to work hard, chose to take the course from him. Other students either, I don't know what he taught, but either avoided his course if they could, or took it from a different professor if they could. And if that were the case, then it might be that people who took it from him got high bar passage rates for reasons that nothing to do with the teacher. That's obviously one problem. In our particular case, are there ways in which one might be able to avoid some of that problem? Think about how your schooling is actually structured. In your first year, what choices do you have? So in the first year, I think students are, more or less randomly allocated to sections. Is that right? And I suppose there must be some evening sections, maybe, so that would be a little non-random. So therefore, you might be able to use the first year results to say, all right, there can't be a selection effect if they're not selected, and then add first year classes you might argue are the most important ones. So you might say, all right, so-and-so obviously does a much better job of training through the bottom than someone else. And you might decide, well, there are other important things, but at least that would be a possibility. But it would work for the reason you raise less well for second and third year classes. Before you have more selection classes. So one possibility, think about the questions and using them. One possibility is to change in some way either what courses people take or who they take them from. All right, that's one tactic. What other tactics occur to you? What else can we change?
You can admit fewer students and admit only smarter students.
Fewer or different? That is to say, you could say, well, let's find out whether LSAT or GPA is a better predictor of bar passage. If it turns out that LSAT is a better predictor, give more weight to that in our admissions and less weight to the GPA. You could also simply ask, is either of them a good predictor? If it turns out that LSAT is a really good predictor, then maybe we should be less willing to take a chance on the students with lower LSATs maybe we should be willing to focus more of our scholarship money on trying to get high LSAT students to come here instead of somewhere else. And there were a variety of things you could do if you knew that that would really be critical condition. Can you see any problems with that tactic? I'm concerned really with problems with the tactic as a way of reading Black Passage. Obviously, any school has multiple objectives, and then one of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow with regard to sustainability is that that rhetoric ignores the fact that in the real world you all have trade-offs of different values. And it might be that the only way of slowing global warming is to keep the people in India and China poor, since those are developing countries. Fossil fuels or coal in particular is a cheap source of energy, so maybe in order to keep CO2 down you would have to keep them from developing or slow their development. That would be a big cost. You're talking about more than 2 billion people. And you have to decide, you know, how does that compare to the cost of living? Similarly here, it might be that there are things you could do which would indeed raise your bar passage rate, but would have negative effects on the things you care about. Not the subject today. The subject today is just how you use statistics to raise bar passage rate. So, and you think anything wrong with the tactic of simply seeing what information we have with students when they came in, shift our admissions in the direction of whatever characteristics ended up correlating with our country.
Any potential problems with that? Before I might give you the wrong answer.
Sure. One, we've got two different tactics we're discussing, seem to me to be the two obvious ones. One of them is changing the education of the students who come here, and the other is changing the education. And I am sure we do not have a tactic of simply starting at the highest LSAT applicant and going down until we get the equals we want. We could have that. I'm sure we don't. If so, if we decided that LSAT was a really good predictor, we could decide to admit a few fewer people at the bottom edge of the distribution and a few more people at the top edge of the higher edge. Notice, by the way, when I say is there a problem, there are really two different sorts of problems you might have. One problem would be concluding that LSAT was important when it wasn't, and the other is not including when it was. The question is, there things you want to watch out for both of those. Yeah.
It's possible that something else causes both high LSAT and bar passage, and it's possible that someone had that something else, but for some reason didn't get a high LSAT. So say something else was hard work. Someone could be a hard worker, but for some reason, I've got a low LSAT, but still a very high probability of passing the bar.
Of course, but that's only useful if we have some way of identifying hard workers. That's what that is really saying. What that's really saying is, no one is planning that you're going to get a perfect prediction. The question is there information we can use to improve the result? If the only measure we have of hard work is LSAT, then the closest we can come to selecting for hard work is select high LSATs. Now, it might be, in the case you're describing, there was something else we hadn't thought of that you could look at, and then that could improve it even more. And I'll be happy talking about not exactly that question, but a related question. One of the points which I was going to raise later, but I will raise now, because it's sort of in the background of some of this, is suppose you are take the U.S. News and Report, suppose you're a 110-level school, and you want to get up to 80. Or suppose the case I've actually been thinking about much more, which is liberal arts colleges, because my kids have, in the last few years, both been applying. Suppose you're a good but not really top-ranked liberal arts college and you want to push up. You have this really serious problem, a problem which doesn't exist in lots of other fields of endeavor. And that is that one of the main variables determining how good you are is how good the students are who come. And one of the main variables determining how good the students are who come is how good you are. So there's therefore a closed loop kind of problem. How, in the general case, does that make more liberal arts colleges? I'll get back to this more later. But how might you solve that problem? Suppose you are the president of a college that's a good liberal arts college you'd like to be one, become one of the top ones. One possibility is you've got enough money, and schools sometimes do this. If you have enough money, you can find. Now, it's hard because the really top schools are also pretty rich. And therefore, the person you really want already has a free ride to Harvard. But the person who doesn't have a free ride to Harvard but gets into Harvard, you might get by offering him a free ride here. Yeah?
That's why it's easier to get from 110 to 80 than it is from 40.
Yes, and the case I'm looking at are really closer to the second category.
But what it seems to me that our discussion suggests a different, and in a sense a more elegant approach to solving this problem, which it seems to me your example points out. What do you want to look for? Everyone wants to look for good students, but what do you want to look for specifically?
Students who are likely to succeed.
Everybody wants to look for students who are likely to
succeed with money.
Maybe if you happen to have money, Harvard's got a lot of money.
Is it students that other people will recognize?
Yes, precisely. What you want to look for are the students the other ones are going to miss. What you want to do is say, is there some characteristic that they're not looking at that's a good predictor? And find the people who are hiring their members. Now, that's at least the answer that's occurring to me. We'll come back to this, because I've got a story coming out of our admissions experience, which I suspect, though I may be wrong, is an example of a school doing exactly what I'm describing. But in any case, so let me go on, and some of this is going to be stuff we already said, because obviously I didn't know in advance. So, who to admit? Bar passage rate is the dependent variable, and the independent variables are the information we had on admissions, such as LSAT, undergraduate grades, maybe undergraduate major, anything else. And you could see which ones predict bar passage and alter your admission policies. That's what we've just been talking about. Doing, why might it not work? Correlation is not causation. What reasons can we think about why changing independent variables might not change dependent variables? And one standard answer in some cases, usually you don't know which is cause and which is effect. All right? Is the direction of causation a problem here? It is not a problem. Because passing the bar in 2011 can't improve your LSAT in 2007. All right? We have the useful feature that time runs in one direction. And since time runs in one direction, there might be something that affects both of them. But it can't be that the later event caused the former event. All right? Or at least if it does, physicists will be very unhappy with you, because causality is one of the sort of basic principles we tend to believe in. So, that's not one. However, here is a different problem. And this one is getting, this is not quite what we were talking about. We're getting in that direction. And that is that there may be variables used in the admissions that are not in your regression for whatever reason. And those are a couple of sort of the harder to quantify ones. So suppose we're looking at students admitted with low LSAT. Or to take the case I was originally thinking about this, suppose we're looking at the students who got into Oberlin or Harvard or Swarthmore who had SAT scores towards the bottom of the range of students there. What would you expect to find if you looked at those students? Yep?
More of like a balance. Like they have, they're the president of their high school.
Or a chess champion, or wrote a computer program that's for the iPhone that's selling and very popular. That's right, because they're not admitted in the same because they got admitted. Why does somebody who has a low SAT get admitted? Because there's something else for it. Now, in this particular case, it's not clear that's very helpful, because what's the most likely explanation? I don't know how many of you people know about this world, but the most likely explanation for what they have going for them is that one or both parents went to the college. That what are referred to as legacy admissions, which I'm disinclined to complain about because my kids had in fact benefited by them. But nonetheless, they are a feature of the world as it exists, a feature which is at least a little hard to justify. And so I suspect if you looked at the lower fringe, you would discover that an unusually high fraction of them were the kids of alumni. But also that an unusually high fraction of them were ones who had other qualifications other than SATs. That wouldn't matter. So the result of that would be that you would actually be, in some sense, underestimating the importance of the LSAT or the SAT. Because here you would have students with low LSATs or low SAT who did very well. Well, if it's legacy admissions, that's not a problem, because having parents or alumni probably doesn't result in you're more likely to do well. But if it's being a hardworking, ingenious, creative person, that probably results in your being more likely to go through college well, graduate, get a good job, pass the bar if it's law school, and so forth. So that would be a problem. You see that by having a selective sample, you are going to
decrease the apparent importance of the things the regression measures relative to things that it doesn't. It doesn't measure because the people who are low on what the regression measures are precisely the ones who are high on something else. Yeah.
Can you fix that by throwing those selected people into another random sample?
That is, the problem is that for bar passage, for example, we don't have data on the bar passage rate at Santa Clara of the students we didn't admit. So, now there's an interesting case, a study which does something sort of like that. It was actually quite clever. And this has to do, one of the questions, which is the same sort of question when we discuss it, is how much good it does to you to go to a good college. And the easy test is to say, what's the average salary of Harvard graduates versus Santa Clara graduates? And that's a very bad test. That's a very bad test because the Harvard graduates, on average, were smarter or harder working in various ways, more qualified before they went to Harvard. That's how they got into Harvard. Right. So what somebody did was to look at students who were admitted to an elite college and then went to a non-elite college instead, presumably often for monetary reasons. So of course they wanted to go to a college close to home or something like that. And compare them with students who were admitted to the same elite college and went to it. And what they were looking at were wages, were salaries, were income. And it turned out that going to Harvard raises your income in your first job, but not thereafter. I should say, I didn't read the paper. I'm describing the summary I saw of it, so I don't swear it's right. It was quite an elegant idea for controlling for, are you good enough to get admitted to Harvard? Yes, they were. What's the benefit of going to Harvard? That evidence would suggest to me, at least, that your first job, they take your having graduated from Harvard as a positive signal, but then after your first job, they've got enough better information on how you did the first job, so that you get that, the importance of that signal.
You said it applies to law school, too, as far as...
I don't know. This was
a
study, I'm pretty sure, about undergraduate colleges. So my impression is that there are people... I don't know. If you looked at current Supreme Court justices, do they know what schools they graduated from?
All IAP.
Are they?
I'm pretty sure.
That's interesting.
It's almost all from... There's only one, I think, like Columbia. The rest is all, like, as far as I know, it's Harvard, Yale. I don't know. There's Stanford on there.
Yeah. Or Chicago would be the other class. Yeah. But it would be an interesting question. It would be also an interesting question if you had some measure of elite up, you know, lawyers who make a lot of money or something. Another interesting measure to see what happens. But then you've got the problem in all of those that you can't easily distinguish between characters who's coming in and the result and the education they got in the school. That's why it struck me as an elegant piece of work. Yep.
Can't you, if you are worried about this selective problem,
yes,
can't you just expunge those samples?
Expunge what? In the case of the legacy people, you could if you know they're legacy people because you have that information. Other than that, I suppose you could try to say, if you actually had the detailed admission information, you could say, is there something on this which says this person is really good for some reason, not shown by the statistics? And you guys both try to eliminate those people if you wanted to. And that would give you better. But there are going to be a lot of cases if you think about the... I don't know enough about admissions, but
it's not an effective correlation, though. Like, you're going to get a... It's not going to corrupt your investigation.
Yeah. But the point is, these problems aren't going to mess up your correlation. They're going to mess up your causation. They're going to mess up the question of why. As I said, take the extreme case. Suppose it turned out that there was no correlation between LSAT and bar passage. But the reason was that the students, that first, there were no low LSAT students in the sample at all because none of them got admitted. And within the narrow range of LSATs you had, people who were towards the bottom of the range were people who were positive in something. So it might be the case that actually LSAT matters. Yeah?
As we're talking about this, are we assuming strong correlation coefficients so that if for some reason we don't get that strong negative one or positive one, then our conclusions would be
very weak, right? That's right. You use probably something like the R-squared because it's a regression, but you would be using some confidence measure. And notice also that, again, there are really two different measures in most of the things like regression. One of them is how sure you are of the effect, the other is how big the effect is. So you might have a case where I'm absolutely sure that LSAT affects bar passage. How much does it affect it? Highest LSAT student has a 1% higher chance than the lowest LSAT student. Alright? That would be a high degree of high significance, small importance. I don't know, importance is a technical term. You can think of it that way. Or you could have one where you say, well,
every point of LSAT raises your chance of passing the bar by 5%. How sure am I? Not at all sure. The chance that the result is bogus just due to random error is 40%. All right, so you have to distinguish those two measures all the time.
And what that implies is that in that particular case is that your regression results will underestimate the importance of LSAT in that case. But there's a further problem, and that is the students who are not admitted aren't in your sample. All right? You might be filtering out students. For example, suppose your rule for admission was admit nobody whose LSAT is below this level and admit nobody whose GPA is below this level. There might be students who basically spent their time in college, you know, socializing and getting drunk and, or whatever, not that kind of what, but something other than things like grades, maybe that they were the students who were very smart, who said to themselves, I don't have to work, why should I bother working? Doesn't much matter where I go to college, it'd be nice to go to Harvard, but I'll manage to get my own educated anywhere, but isn't it fun, you know, being a teenager? Maybe those are going to be the ones with really high LSATs and really low GPAs, and none of them are in your sample because you didn't admit any of them. All right, so that's going to be a further point.
And that's getting to the point I was making before, is that I was thinking about while my kids were applying to these things, that in order to make a school good, you need good students, but all of them will accept the school that's already good, unless there is a group that Harvard is missing. And this is what I think of as the St. Olaf strategy, and this is purely a theory. Theory deduced from our interaction with one college. Because my kids were both homeschooled. They were both home unschooled, which means they didn't have textbooks, they didn't have a syllabus, they didn't have any of the stuff that, except SAT scores, really, any of the stuff that the standard college admission people are looking for. And none of the colleges said we don't like homeschool students. One of them came pretty close to saying we have no idea how to deal with homeschool students. Can't you get your kid to take class somewhere to get us a grade? One college responded in a way strongly signaling that they thought being homeschooled was a good thing. This was where our daughter was applying to college. School of St. Olaf. And she got an email in the fall saying our application deadline is the end of December. But we think you ought to know that we have merit scholarships available. The application deadline for the merit scholarships is a month earlier. And we have found that homeschool students are sometimes very well qualified. She applied a month earlier. They admitted her, offered her a good deal of money. She ended up going to Oberlin instead, which also offered her a good deal of money because she thought it was probably correct. It was an academically better school. Let me tell you what I believe is happening. Anybody know anything about either St. Olaf or Oberlin? Oberlin is a top-level liberal arts college, which is probably going down, as far as we can tell. My wife went, that's why my daughter was looking at the admission there. My wife went to Oberlin, and her impression is that it is not as good a school as it was before. Oberlin, however, has an associated music school, which is one of the top ones in the country. So if you want to become a professional musician and be in a place where you can take college courses, you enroll in Oberlin, mainly enroll in, I forget what it's called, because it's got a separate name rather than the college, but you're at a college. St. Olaf is about a half step down from Oberlin as far as it looks stuff like SAT, average SAT of admitted students, and it has a music program comparable to Oberlin's. And my theory is that St. Olaf is trying to replace Oberlin. And that some clever person at St. Olaf said, where are there good students in the other space? Right? And it occurred to him that the Yale School was a niche. And we talked with the admission person at St. Olaf. And the admission person at St. Olaf said, what really blew us away about your daughter's application was the list of 400 books she had read. So there, it occurs that they ask, essentially, how can we focus on a niche that's being missed and thus push ourselves up? Now, the other case which occurred to me, which is not in the student level at all, but is the faculty equivalent, suppose you want to make yourself into a top university, which requires not having, Top students are really good, but what you really want to have are some really good professors. All right? Well, one solution is to get somebody to give you $100 million, and then with luck, you can hire away some really sharp people. But there's another and more elegant solution, and that is to find the niche that's not being served. And the case here is the school that was actually my first position as a professor, which was Virginia Polytechnic Institute, VPI. And VPI, in its economics department, had something called the Public Choice Center, because there were a number of economists who were interested in the then relatively new project of using economics to try to understand political systems. Instead of simply saying economics is about the market and political systems are political science, the project was, no, same people in both. We ought to have the same model of behavior. We as economists think that people in the market act on rational self-interest. Let's assume the people in the political system, candidates, voters, government, bureaucrats, everybody, act on rational self-interest. Can we get any interesting predictions? That should not be good. And the beauty of doing it this way, yes, right, there are two elements to it. The first is that the same professor who wouldn't come to you in general because you're a level B school and he can get a position at a level A school will come to you if he knows that the only other five people in the world who are interested in what he's interested in are there. All right? And the second thing is that if you guess right, this new niche will turn out to be important. They'll get attention. And VPI got its timing just a little bit off, because it was either a year or 2 years after Jim Buchanan left VPI that he got the Nobel Prize for his work in public choice theory. But nonetheless, it struck me as an interesting story of sort of how you go about trying to improve yourself in the same basic, not identical approach, but very much the same kind of approach. All right. So I guess going back a moment, the fact that your students who are not admitted, similarly, a different version of that problem is the observation that if you're admitting largely by SAT, you aren't going to know if there are students with really low SATs who are really good for some other reason. They're never going to be in your sample. So you will, again, you might at least end up overestimating how important SAT is, because you're looking over a fairly narrow range where all the students are about the same, and therefore where the difference among them depends not so much on how smart they are, but on whether they got a good night's sleep the night before they took the test, and variables of that sort. All right, small range is not good. All right, so the next one, which we've already discussed, but go over it again briefly, and then discuss the problem, which we already really discussed, is we regress bar passing grade on what class a student took and what grades he got on them. And as I say, if you observe students of class X were less likely to pass Y more, you might grade a bar passing grade as described. And similarly, you might say if grades in a certain class predict bar passage rates, then we might say, well, people who can't get at least a C in that class or maybe a B minus, we're going to advise them to drop out. They can do any of those things. In each of these cases, the question is why it might not work. You already answered the first one, because it might be that what's going on is that students who took the class X is known to be a gut class. I don't know if they use that slang nowadays, but it used to be the college slang for basket weaving class, for a class which is very easy to get a good grade in without working very hard, whereas class Y is, as I say, Pythagoras class, and students are self-selecting, so the better students are taking the Pythagoras class. And so that would be one problem. And the grades in Z, I'm not so sure. I don't know if there are good problems with my second one. Can you think of any good reasons why the fact that doing well in a particular class correlated with passing the bar wasn't a reason to discourage you who did badly in that class? I don't have a good answer for that, but I bet there's some, if we're clever enough, I bet we could think of some scenario where that not work. Yeah, I'm trying to think of an equivalent to what we've been doing for that last one. I don't have a good one ready to hand, but I'll think of one you would think of. So suppose our strategy is we analyze the data and we say, are there classes where your grade in that class is a good predictor of your biomass strength? If they are, we could then say we will try to get students to drop out if they do badly in that class. Now, one problem, of course, is those are probably going to be upper-level classes, and that's pretty late for dropping out. But putting that aside, suppose we discovered that students who did badly in property, which is the first-year class, were likely to not pass the bar, could we then say, instead of saying we'll drop you if your average is below such and such, we'll drop you if your average giving heavier weight to property than other things is below such and such. You can imagine that strategy if we have the data. And I'm not sure why it might not work, but I have thought of a good reason in that case. But any of these, I think part of the game, as it were, for stretching your mind is to try to say, all right, well, here's what looks like a good idea. Why might it not work? Why might it be a bad idea? How about professors? All right. Not only students can get rid of, but get rid of professors, too. See how bar passage rate depends on which courses from what professor. And so, as you say, you could rearrange who teaches what. And the obvious problem that we've discussed before is if the selection is not among courses but among professors, which I don't think is in the first year, but can be in other years. But even in the first year, for a moment, let me think about this. Suppose what's really going on is that one of these two teachers teaches night classes and the other one doesn't. And I am assuming, though I may be wrong, that night classes tend to be taken largely by part-time students. Well, I don't know whether part-time students are more or less likely or less likely to pass the bar the first time, but it would be a little surprising if they were equally likely. They're different. Part-time students are different a whole lot of ways from full-time students. So you might be getting a bogus result due to what people were teaching. Right? Work better, of course, if you've got 10 years of data, presumably. And even then, my impression is that the school always wants professors who are willing to teach at night. And that those professors who are willing to teach at night, therefore, like to do it pretty often. So you might get a bogus result there. But the other result, obviously, is if it's a case where the student can choose which professor to take it from, the same problem before, you might have students self-sort between the hard and easy. Or even between the intellectually interesting and the intellectually boring, in a sense, as you can imagine. That what's going on is not that one of them grades harder, but that one of them covers more material more deeply or something, has a reputation for that, so you're going to have to work hard. And the other one does a better job for students who aren't willing to work hard. Right? I mean, it's not, the point we'll be coming to later, it's not as if everything has an unambiguous ranking. Maybe the same person who's a good teacher for student A is a bad teacher for student B, and so forth. All right. So in each of these cases, what do we have to know in order to figure out whether correlation is probably causation? And one obvious question is how students are assigned both to courses and to professors. Now, I don't know if I've mentioned to you, but I actually came across in some discussions of a little statistical analysis regarding bar passage rate what looked to me like a very good natural experiment. And I haven't looked at it carefully enough to be sure I'm right, but let me describe it to you anyway. And that is, I think the current situation is, and you can correct me because it's not like I've been a student here, that if you get below some grade point average in your first year classes, you are required to do the legal analysis research and writing. Is that right? Or I think it's that. There's something you're required to do if you do that. So you've got to cut off.
I may have mentioned this before, but it's interesting enough, so I'll mention it again. I've got it. Yeah, here we are. So let's suppose we have a graph, and this is first year GPA.
And this is first-time bar passage rate. What would you expect the shape of that graph to be, loosely speaking? Which way is it going to slope? Up.
Right.
You would expect that on average,
I'm assuming this is going to be whatever the lowest grade is that you can get in your first year and not get that and be allowed to continue, and then you would expect that this would be going on like that. Let's suppose that this is the cutoff point at which you have to take what they call LARA, but if you actually think about it, it's actually LARAW, because it's LARAW, not LAWRA, which is sort of interesting that the more pronounceable version ends up taking over. What would you expect to see if LARAW actually had a sizable effect on whether you passed the bar? You would expect that the pattern would look like that. All right? That these people are a tiny bit better than these people because they've got slightly higher GPA, but these people got the extra teaching and these people didn't. I gather that no such pattern appears as far as I can tell. And again, you'd like to know more before deciding whether the program actually works. But it's interesting because it's a kind of a natural experiment of a sort which occasionally feeds you information. As I may have mentioned, the book Freakonomics, to my mind, is fun really for a statistics, not as economics. So the economics in it is pretty much all sort of obvious economics to any economist. What's clever about the book is how you go about testing those predictions. Yeah.
Why do you think that there's no correlation? Just because you've seen some data?
Yes, correct. I have heard a report on the relevant data, and I asked that question. And as far as I could tell, if I understood it correctly. But I don't want to be too confident about this, because it wasn't like I did any research on this. This is just in the course of a discussion of something else. But I believe that's right. That the line really does just keep going. With, I'm sure, lots of random variation, of course. Should have left that on the photograph, but I didn't. All right. So this is an obvious problem. Let me go on to my concern about the ABA, and some of which I have passed on to our dean, who is actually a part of the relevant process, as I am not. And the question is, people in the ABA, I don't know what's actually happening, but there's at least been some pressure in the ABA to say, look, we don't want students going to law school and then failing to pass the bar. That makes us look bad. That's bad for them. So therefore, maybe in deciding which law schools the ABA will certify, we ought to have some minimum bar passage rate that is required. And the question is, what happens if you do that, and why is it a mistake? What's going to happen? Let's put it differently. What law schools do you think are going to argue against this? Yep. Are going to argue against it? They'll pass easily enough. What? The lower end law schools. What would you expect the characteristics of lower end law schools to be? They're getting students who are not as smart. So that you would expect then that this is going to handicap law schools which, no doubt not by their own intent, specializing in low-ed students. It's going to make it harder for students with low LSATs and similar things to go to law school at all. All right? Why is it a mistake? Why should we not be using that measure to decide whether a law school is doing a good job? Yep.
Because that they could have a great school with not very intelligent students who the students cannot pass despite the great school.
That's right. Or putting it differently, they could be a school that's really good at getting not very intelligent students past the bar. It's just even be really good at it and still not do as well as Harvard does with the student discount. All right. So what do I want you to do? Suppose for a moment that you want, suppose the ABA does want, think about two different objectives. One of the objectives is eliminating law schools that do a bad job of teaching students and only those law schools. And the other objective is generating information for students. Because after all, you could go to a non-
ABA-approved school. I don't know, they'll probably depend on what state, whether that will have consequences if you take the bar and such. But if you're a student, what is the information you would like about law school? Yep.
I don't really know how to phrase very well, but some objective measure of how they took of the distance traveled by students.
By students in general? Isn't there something you'd like even better than that?
Students at your own...
That's it, exactly. You don't... So, if you're a podunk, somebody will only get into podunk law school, if there is one, you don't care how good they, the job they do with Harvard students, with the kind of students they get at Harvard. You want to know how good a job they should do with students like you. Exactly. Let's continue.
So you want some, like, either... Yeah, you want some objective measure of where students started and where they finished, and you want to know about the student's strengths so you can compare them to your own strengths.
So for a moment, suppose the ABA wanted to generate in some convenient form for everybody that kind of information. How do you do it? We've got the tools now. That's what we've been developing.
You'd want to find something that correlates almost perfectly with whatever...
Take LSAT. Suppose we're going to use LSAT as our measure. You can have a fancier version, but let's say the simple world versus LSAT. Now, what do you ask of each school?
Admit this test, so are you students?
All the students. I'm assuming that most schools and students who are applying take LSATs. What information do we want in order to generate the information the students want? Yes?
You'd want to know how many students at that LSAT score?
At each LSAT score. And what is the mechanism we use to, given that we don't have, you know, a huge number in every single LSAT score, what is the statistical device we use to answer the question, how does such and such depend on such and such? In this case, how does bar passage rate at this school depend on your LSAT? This is the question we want to answer. That you just gave us correctly the question we want to answer. We use a regression. That's what regressions are for. Forget about the C's because I'm assuming we only have LSAT, but the C's are assuming we had some other things as well. You run a regression in which you have bar passage rate is equal to a constant plus another constant times your LSAT score. Fit that regression. All right, so what are we going to have? Same stuff we were talking about before, except it's LSAT instead of GPA. You're going to have some line like this for Santa Clara. And that tells you, as a function of your LSAT, how large you are, how likely you are. Let's see, this is one, this is the certainty of passing. And the highest LSAT students are close to that. They're 0.9 or something, 0.98 or some high number. All right. Now you would do the same regression for Harvard. And you know what you might find out? I don't know if you would find out, but what you might find out was it looked like that. You can't go above one, but... Now you're not going to have very much data at this end, but Harvard admits some low LSAT students for various reasons, probably mostly for diversity reasons. What is that? What are those two lines? This one is Harvard. And this one is SC. What does that tell you? Yep.
That at the lower LSAT scores, something's happening at Harvard that makes it more difficult to pass the bar.
That's right. And so what it tells you is that if all you're interested in is passing the bar, if you're below here, you ought to go to SCU. If you're above here, if you can, you ought to go to Harvard. That's much better information than knowing what the average bar passage rate of those schools is. All right. And all is going to be in the form of A. This is A Harvard. This is A SCU. A is the constant. That's showing that the LSAT is zero, which you don't actually have, but we're going to ignore that complication. And then this is the slope. All right. And it might be that there's another school up here which
Why isn't any school like that where the really smart students are so bored that they don't learn anything? Because it's a school that's really specializing at the low end. That's a possibility too. That would be the information you really want. That's what I would argue at least they ought to be doing. So therefore they could say, we are delighted to certify you people. You do terribly for smart students, but that's all right, smart students aren't going to go there anyway. And you do better than even the good schools on the low end students. Right. So that I'm going to argue is the right way to use statistics for this purpose. Alright, let me now try to do a summary in part so that while doing the summary you can also ask questions about the parts that you don't think you know the answer to. So this is sort of a summary of what I think you ought to know after our whatever 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks of statistics. You ought to understand. Yep. The answer is it is in the 2009 PowerPoints. I'm planning to, the PowerPoint I'm doing here, which I've added some things to in the course of after deciding to do PowerPoints here, I will be putting up there. It's not yet. But this slide I don't think I changed at all. So I think it's, if you actually looked at the 2009, and it's called something like stat plus multiple regression or something, stat plus mul, something like that. That one. Is where it is. But as I say, I'll try to remember tonight. I also haven't put up the last two recordings, so I'll try to do that tonight too. We get up to date on that. So the things that you ought to know, first from the very beginning of what we're doing, ways in which you can display and summarize data, which are things like a histogram, which is the frequency thing showing. So that, for example, suppose in a class larger than this that I was looking at some measure of student evaluations in the class. And suppose it turned out that the histogram... Sorry. I've got it. Yes. No, this is right. Suppose the histogram looked sort of like that. All right. This is how good they think the class is, roughly speaking. That would be interesting, because what that would tell me is there is one group of students for whom I'm doing quite a bad job, and one for whom I'm doing quite a good job. Actually, this is not imaginary. I've obviously drawn that one, but I have not uncommonly seen that kind of results, and I've never really figured out good things to do about it. Ideally what we want to do is to have only these students take this class and have these students take someone else's class who's better at teaching that. And it doesn't even have to be smart or stupid. Naturally, I like to think that, aha, I do a good job of teaching smart students, and it's just the students are further. But it might be not that at all. It might be that there are some students who haven't used PowerPoints until this day. Maybe there are some students who PowerPoints work really well with, and others who hate it, and therefore you get that way. Yeah.
Why aren't there two groups there that like your class? Look at their two comps, right?
Yep. So, but this is how much they like it. Those people down there don't like it. That's a low score on my evaluation. So those are the ones who said, this is one of the worst classes I've ever been in. Whereas these ones say, this is a wonderful class.
There are two comps and a trough, right?
Yeah, the trough means that hardly anybody is, a few people are neutral. But that most people, they either love it or hate it.
Okay.
That's the pattern.
It would probably help if you label the
attributes. I'm sorry. You're right. This is rating, professor's rating. No, sorry. This is professor's rating. You're perfectly right. Rating. And this is number. So this is saying there are 7 students who rated me the lowest possible, 8 a little higher, 9 a little higher, 9, 10 a little higher here, only 4 students rated me in the middle, but then here are a bunch of students rating me high. And you have lots of context for which you might get that, right? That is, you could be interesting to know if bar exam score set that pattern, for example. They might. And for that matter, it would be interesting to me when I look at midterm or final exam scores. Because it's not the same information, but it's related information. These people are probably people who weren't learning as much as these people. whether for my fault or their fault, either way, they're going to be less happy and he's more happy. So,
so that's the histogram.
And the median and the mean, I was just having a few days ago an online exchange with somebody vis-a-vis income distribution in different countries. And the person was trying to claim that it was the median that was much the more important number. And the reason he thinks that is that he's saying, look, a few people like Bill Gates are going to pull the mean way up, but that hardly matters to anybody. And you can set up distributions like that, but as I tried to demonstrate, you can also set up distributions where the median is less informative. Imagine two different populations where the median income is exactly the same, but one of them, the people below the median, are way, way down, and the other is a little bit down. Well, that's going to show up in the mean, in the average, in the mean, but it's not going to show up in the median. And similarly on the upside, so in both of those cases. So it's really a matter of realizing what mean and median mean, and then thinking about which one you care about in any particular. Right. If you wanted, here's an interesting one. Suppose you are designing an airplane or a ship or something, and you care about the weight of the passengers, and you're going to have 150 passengers or 1,000 passengers. What you care about is the mean weight of people, not the median weight. On the other hand, what's a good example the other way? I'm not sure. But I guess if you're imagining wanting to make sure that you want to know when to serve dinner, say. You might be more interested in the median time people want a dinner, because half of them will come before that and half after that, so you want to sort of spread on both sides of that, whereas the mean might be skewed a whole lot by people who ate very, very late, even if there weren't very many of them. So, but in any case, just realizing what these things mean and what they're used for. Then the one I've tried to make a good deal of attention to is significant and confidence intervals, what those mean, and I don't think I have that on the list, but I should. Well, I do it down there with the regression result, but in general, that terms like significance are statements about how strong the evidence is, not how strong the effect is. All right, you've got evidence for an effect. If I pull a random coin out of my pocket and flip it a million times, I will get highly significant evidence that it's not a fair coin. Even if it's very close to a fair coin, because a million flips will be enough to show up very small differences. If I pull a two-sided coin out of my pocket and flip it twice, I will not get significant evidence that it's two-sided, because the chance of 1 in 4 of getting that result from a fair coin. All right, that's not a serious result. So you ought to know what the idea of testing a conjecture and the idea of the null hypothesis and the alternative hypothesis. So that in the standard statistical procedure, the null hypothesis says basically what I'm looking for isn't there. The null hypothesis is this person is innocent. The null hypothesis is this is a fair coin. And the alternative hypothesis is your guess at what's happening. This is a double-headed coin, or this is the coin biased towards flipping heads. This person is guilty. Jelly beans cause acne, whatever. All right? And the normal procedure thing done with a bunch of different procedures, what you're normally doing is saying you're running some kind of statistical test which will tell you if the null hypothesis is true, how likely is it that I'll get the results I actually got? All right? So getting results which are unlikely if the null hypothesis is true is evidence against the null. Doesn't tell you what your probabilistic conclusion is, but it's evidence against. So each of these, when you're talking about a significant result, or if you say our estimate is that the regression coefficient is somewhere between 0.4 and 0.5, we're saying the odds that we would have gotten these results if it was either less than 0.4 or more than 0.5 are less than, say, 0.05. Level you're setting it. So the confidence intervals are where you've got some number you've estimated and you're trying to figure out where it is, and the confidence interval says it's between these numbers, not with this probability, but if it weren't there, here is how low the probability is that we would have gotten the result we got. All right. And similarly, a measure of significance is saying how likely is it we would have gotten this result if there was nothing there. If the guy was innocent and just by chance his DNA matched, or how likely is it we would
would get the result if the coin was fair and just happened to come up heads three times. So you need to understand the idea of a null hypothesis and alternative hypothesis, and you ought to understand the difference between a one-tailed and a two-tailed test. Is that clear or not? One-tailed test is where your alternative hypothesis tells you which direction you expect the error to be in. So if your hypothesis, as in one of the questions I had on the syllabus, if your hypothesis is that SDU students are on average older than 24, then a sample which came out of 23 would not support that hypothesis, even though it is evident that they're not 24. So then you would use a single-tailed test. You would say, how likely is it they came out at 25? How likely is it that I would have gotten a number of at least 25 if the real number was 24? All right? People understand that? Understand it? All right. The normal distribution and the central limit theorem. Normal distribution is just that funny bell curve, which for any of you who are mathematically inclined, what the bell curve really is something of the form e to the minus x squared. Except that x is the difference from the mean, not the actual value of the thing, and it's x squared divided by something, because some of them are y and some of them are times. But that, if you like math, that's all a normal distribution is an inverse squared exponential. But the important point, aside from the fact that some distributions are normal, the particular point is that if you have a non-normal distribution and you take a sample of a given size from it, imagine that as your experiment, you do that experiment many times, you would get some distribution for the averages you got each of those times. So we pick 50 students, average their height, average their age is 24. Pick another 50 students, average their age is 25. Another 23. Another is 23 and a half. All right? There's a distribution of those averages. The larger the sample size is, the closer that distribution will be to normal. And that's very useful because a lot of the time you don't know the underlying distribution, but that's all right if you're taking fairly large samples, and so you have good reason to expect that the distribution of the means of the samples is going to be normal. And if so, you can then use the z-test, because the z-test simply tells you on this normal distribution how likely is it that we're further than right? Here, z is the number of standard deviations back from the mean. So if our result is three standard deviations from the mean, we can say how likely is it that we would be at least three standard deviations out from the mean. That will give you your p number. All right? And I think, if I remember correctly, that I had you actually doing that on a very simple simple case in the problems I gave you. All right, you ought to know what a correlation coefficient shows. Correlation coefficient doesn't tell you how much one thing affects another. It tells you how closely the two are related. That is to say, this line and this line could be the same correlation coefficient. The question is, how nearly are all the points on the line? One regression results single or multiple means. All right, a regression is just drawing a line which fits the relation between two variables. That's a single regression. A simple regression is just y equals a plus bx. All right, and you're finding the values. That's what I was in my imagination doing there. If you have y, this is x, you've got a bunch of points. A regression is a mathematical procedure that draws the line through those points, which comes closest to fitting them, defined as minimizing the sum square errors. And it has the form y equals a plus bx. This is a, because when x is 0, y equals a. So it's where it hits the line, and b is the slope. It tells you as x goes up how fast the point is. So that's one very simple way of doing the equivalent of what a correlation coefficient is doing, except this time it's telling you what the slope of that line is. And you can then ask of the amount by which y varies, the amount by which these points vary from their average, how much of it is explained by the line. So you can say, all right, if we drew simply a horizontal line through at the average and calculated the sum squared deviations from that, how much of that would be eliminated when we do this instead? And that's what the R squared is. R squared of 1 means all of the deviation from the mean is explained by the line. R squared of 1 is a perfect thing. And R squared of 0 means that line does no better than a horizontal line in the average value. Knowing x tells you not to use that line. So R squared is a measure of how well you would fit the line. T is a measure of how sure you are that D is not 0. You can think of T as equivalent to how many standard deviations above the mean something is. Except that in this case, it's from the regression how sure we are that it actually slows up. Which is a question you're asking, you're saying, does the death penalty determine? Know how sure are we to take something down, how sure are we that as we increase the fraction of murderers we execute, the number of murderers that are put down. Alright, makes sense. So that's what T tells you. And if you go from this case, which is a simple regression, to a modable regression, the modable regression is of the form A Y equals A plus B1 X1 plus V2, X2, and so forth, where what are those X's? They are LSAT, GPA, part-time or full-time, male or female, whatever variables you think might explain bar passage rate. All right? So a multiple regression is doing the same thing as a single regression, except instead of saying there's one variable which we think partly determines another, we're saying there's several which together determine. And notice that all of these are linear regressions, so as we discussed before, if the real relation was like that, we wouldn't pick it up with a linear regression. For that, you would need a fancier, something analogous, but you wouldn't be drawing straight lines anymore. You'd be drawing some more complicated shaped lines. Okay. Question? No. All right. So, and we want you to know what can go wrong. That is, how statistical results can be presented to mislead, and how the statistics, whether or not intentionally, can mislead. So that XKCD is one nice example of how statistical results can be presented to mislead, and it might be even unintentional if the person who did the experiments wasn't clever enough, or what if those different colors were done by 30 different people, each with a different theory? Suppose that the green jelly bean test was done by somebody who, for some bizarre reason, really believed that green jelly beans and no other jelly beans caused acne. He's telling you the truth when he says, I ran this and I got a 0.05 result, so you should believe me. How does he know that 27 other people ran similar things with other colors and got no result? All right? Questions? All right, I don't think we're going to have time to go over the couple of problems that I had on the syllabus, but I expect that we will discuss them at least briefly next time. There are things you have to hand in. They're just things I thought it would be useful for you to think about.